ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National.
Very suave, erudite kind of guy.
We're here to surprise, delight, and maybe enrage you from time to time. We go where our curiosity leads.
Let's talk crazy. Let's act crazy. Let's be crazy, because then the enemy doesn't know what you're thinking.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why was Ben Robert Smith granted bail? Hi, I'm Damien Carrick and this is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. This week, Ben Robert Smith began reporting to police as he awaits a possible war crimes trial. It's one of the bail conditions imposed on the former soldier by the New South Wales local court last Friday. The 47-year-old was arrested earlier this month and charged with five counts of the war crime of murder allegedly committed during his time serving in Afghanistan between 2009 and 2012. On Sunday, Robert Smith addressed the media, asserting his innocence and vowing to use a future criminal trial to clear his name. Graham Blewett is a former prosecutor with the International War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. He went on to work for many years as a magistrate in New South Wales. Graham, what's the legal test for granting bail?
In relation to the charges Ben Robert Smith is confronting, the charges of murder and aiding and abetting murder under the Commonwealth Criminal Code requires the court to refuse bail unless the accused can establish that there are exceptional circumstances justifying bail being granted. The onus is on Mr. Ben Robert Smith to establish that exceptional circumstances do exist, and that is a test that he has to satisfy the court on the balance of probabilities, and he has to establish that there are in fact exceptional circumstances. Once the court rules on that, and if the court decides that there are no exceptional circumstances, then bail will be refused. However, if the accused is able to convince the judge that there are exceptional circumstances why bail should be granted, then the court goes on to consider the risks imposed, or risks involved rather, in the granting of bail. And I can go through those a little bit later if you wish.
Yes, and those two, just to flag them, are flight risk and maybe potential interference with witnesses. But let's start with that first part of the test. Were there or weren't there exceptional circumstances? What were the arguments of the defence and the prosecution about whether or not there were exceptional circumstances? Let's start with the defence.
The defence basically argued that he would be in custody an extremely long period of time if bail was refused. Mr. Howell, the lawyer for Mr. Ben Robert Smith, made extensive arguments and made submissions to the judge as to the delays that would be involved in keeping him in custody and at the same time trying to prepare his defence. One of the main arguments put by the defence, and I think the main one that influenced the magistrate, or sorry, the judge rather, when he came to consider bail, was that the involvement of national security information and evidence that is likely to be produced would involve an extensive series of events that require declassification of material. There are steps along the way that would allow the accused to challenge any decision if that was necessary, and appeals could be made. The judge had experience involving cases where national security interests were relevant and were involved, and he took the view, in agreement with the accused's lawyer, that it would take a number of years before that matter would go to trial with the national security interests and being involved.
And the judge was also concerned, or took on board the argument put forward by the defence, that, look, these processes could take many years, but also if the applicant, if Ben Robert Smith stayed in custody, there'd be no way that he could
access and discuss this national security information material with his legal team because, you know, you can't just kind of bus in folders full of documents into a prison which have national security content.
That's exactly right. And the national security material, if it is to be released, has to be kept in a very secure area. It requires secure transportation, and no facilities within the jail would enable Ben Robert Smith to confer discreetly with his lawyers. And in that sense, he would be severely prejudiced.
In effect, he wouldn't be able to participate in his own defence because he wouldn't be able to talk to his lawyers about this information because he wouldn't be allowed to see it because he was in jail.
That's exactly right, Damien. Yes, that's the situation. And that was one of the main matters that influenced the judge to grant bail in the end.
What was the prosecution argument with respect to whether or not this case fell into the category of exceptional circumstances?
The prosecution position was that they opposed bail being granted. They conceded, though, that it was unlikely that he would reoffend, and that's one of the considerations that the judge must take into account when granting bail. He must just determine whether or not there are any risks of further offending. So the prosecution agreed with the defence that that was not a matter of concern. But apart from that, the prosecution took the position that he was a flight risk. It was submitted to the court that Ben Robert Smith had made arrangements to move overseas and to live there, and he had sufficient means to achieve that end. So the prosecution took the position that he was a flight risk and would not appear to answer the charges, and of course that's one of the significant factors of whether bail should be granted or not.
The prosecution also mentioned that another person has been charged with similar criminal offences, SAS soldier Oliver Schultz. He had faced a committal and a trial date had been set. Why did they mention that?
I think that was in the context that the defence lawyers at the beginning of the bail application made a submission that the proceedings against Mr. Ben Robert Smith were extraordinary and with little precedent. So in that context, the prosecution submitted to the judge when considering bail that there were in fact precedents and that Mr. Schultz had been arrested, charged and was facing trial with the trial date being set. So there had been some precedent for these charges or charges of this nature to proceed in Australia.
So it wasn't a completely out-of-the-box exceptional circumstances scenario. And how did the prosecution respond to the defence assertions about the issues around delay?
The prosecution had indicated to the court that there would be substantial service of the brief on the accused and his lawyers by the end of July this year. And that, however, it turned out, once discussions took place in the courtroom, that that did not include the national security material, which I think the prosecution conceded would be a lengthy process.
So before we come to the unacceptable risks, the second part of the test, what did New South Wales local court judge Grogan decide on this point of whether or not there were exceptional circumstances?
Yes, he was convinced that exceptional circumstances did exist, primarily because of the delays that would be involved and the difficulties that the accused would have in conferring with his lawyers about national security material, which would be very relevant to the court proceedings.
So, Graham Blewett, coming to the second part of the test, what did the defence argue with respect to whether or not the accused posed any unacceptable risks if he was allowed out on bail? So two possible risks, the flight risk and also witness interference. Let's start with flight risk.
Those two that you just mentioned were the main considerations, the main risks that the judge had to be satisfied that any risk could be, whether it could be mitigated or not. In relation to flight risk, the judge took the view that conditions of bail could be met which would mitigate the risk of flight. And those mitigating factors, including him reporting to police three times a week, with him surrendering his passport, not approaching any points of departure. And in terms of the risk of failing to appear, imposed a $250,000 bail requirement that a surety be offered for forfeit that amount if he failed to appear.
The father of Ben Robert Smith is actually a former Western Australian Supreme Court justice, and he was happy to provide that assurance.
That's correct. That was made known to the court, and the court accepted that.
Also, there was discussion about he had been in and out of the country a number of times over the last few years, and he'd always returned, and he had been subject to surveillance and monitoring, and that would continue. So the feeling was that he was not a flight risk.
I don't accept that, Damien. I think the prosecution took a particular view that with his arrangements being made to live overseas, what you say is true about him always returning. But what was of concern to the prosecution was, as I understand it, that the arrangements he was making to move overseas with his family, those arrangements were being made without Mr. Ben Robert Smith notifying the OSI.
The Office of Special Investigations.
That's correct. I'm sorry, yes. And Ben Robert Smith knew that he was under investigation by the OSI and failed to inform them of what he was intending to do in terms of moving to reside overseas. So the prosecution relied upon that as a demonstration that he was, in fact, a flight risk.
Well, coming to the second argument around whether or not he poses an unacceptable risk if allowed out on bail, there was a question of witness interference. What did both sides argue on that point?
The investigative journalists, Chris Masters and Nick McKenzie, had published material that Mr. Ben Robert Smith said it defamed him. So he commenced defamation proceedings in New South Wales, in Sydney. And the proceedings went on for some time. Witnesses were called, including fellow SAS officers who served with Mr. Ben Robert Smith in Afghanistan. At the end of those proceedings, the judge ruled that he was satisfied that the defendants had established that Ben Robert Smith, on the balance of probabilities, was a war criminal, and accordingly, Ben Robert Smith then lost his defamation proceedings. The evidence that was called at those defamation proceedings included evidence that Ben Robert Smith had tried to influence his former colleagues about the evidence that they should give. That was detected by surveillance undertaken by the Australian Federal Police. And on that basis, the prosecution said that there was a risk that Ben Robert Smith, now that he's charged with war crimes, would again attempt to interfere with prosecution witnesses.
So, Graham, what the argument of the prosecution was that in the previous civil defamation action, the judge had found that Ben Robert Smith had sought to interfere with witnesses, and therefore there was a risk that he might do the same if he was allowed out on bail.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And how did the defence respond to that assertion?
The defence submitted to the court that conditions of bail could be imposed that would mitigate against those risks. And in the end, the judge accepted that. In terms of his ability to communicate in that regard, the court imposed a condition that he only have one telephone, one laptop or computer, and that the Australian Federal Police be given access at any time to that material. The court also indicated and in fact warned Mr. Ben Robert Smith that should he breach any bail, that his bail would be refused, and that in this regard he knows that he's been under surveillance by the AFP and that is likely to continue.
And he was granted bail last Friday by New South Wales local court judge Greg Grogan. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. And today we're focusing on the prosecution of Ben Roberts Smith, the former soldier and Victoria Cross recipient who's been arrested and charged with five counts of the war crime of murder during his time serving in Afghanistan. Ben Robert Smith strenuously maintains his innocence and denies the charges. My guest is Graham Blewett. He's a former prosecutor with the International War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. He went on to work for many years as a magistrate in New South Wales. Graham, also on Friday afternoon, at the end of this hearing that we both watched together via YouTube, New South Wales local court judge Greg Grogan released a 24-page statement of alleged facts prepared by the prosecution. What do we know about the five charges which Ben Roberts-Smith is facing?
The facts on the fact sheet as released by the court sets out the circumstances of each of the five charges of murder. One of those involved Mr. Ben Roberts-Smith being accused of actually killing the victim himself. The remaining three charges relate to him aiding and abetting his fellow colleagues in committing murder. It was alleged that he was using the term blooding his colleagues into committing these crimes. So it's alleged that he ordered those crimes to be committed. When Australia adopted the International Criminal Court's statute, the Australian legislation did not incorporate the concept of ordering someone to kill somebody. Rather, they accepted the well-known legal proposition of aiding, abetting, procuring or counselling a crime. So that accounts for why Mr. Ben Roberts-Smith has been charged with aiding and abetting his colleagues to murder the victims. Then the final charge, was a war crime in that with another person, Mr. Ben Roberts-Smith was complicit in murdering the victim.
And what do we know from the 24-page statement of alleged facts from the prosecution about the circumstances in which these alleged events took place? They're asserting that at the time of these deaths, the deceased were not an active part of hostilities and were under the effective control of the ADF, the Australian Defence Force.
That's an essential component of the crimes. There was a war taking place which involved the Taliban and the Australian SAS and other ADF forces in Afghanistan were involved in an ongoing war where people were being killed on both sides. However, the laws of war and the Geneva Conventions provide that once a person is no longer a combatant and is effectively under control of, in this case, the SAS, then those persons are afforded the protections offered by the Geneva Conventions. And by killing someone in such a situation, then that amounts to the crime of murder. And that forms the basis of these charges.
What did we learn from the 24-page statement of alleged facts about the prosecution witnesses? Some of them have been given indemnities. Tell me about that.
Yes, there were several witnesses identified by a pseudonym who would be giving evidence for the prosecution at the trial. And it was indicated in the statement of facts that some of those had participated in the alleged crimes being committed by the SAS in Afghanistan, and that those witnesses had been indemnified, meaning that they would not be prosecuted for those charges in return for their evidence against Mr. Ben Roberts-Smith.
So are we talking there about the soldiers who were perhaps ordered or told by Ben Roberts-Smith to allegedly kill the deceased?
That's a possibility. I don't know. The fact sheet does not indicate that.
How common is it for prosecutions to provide this sort of immunity in a murder case or a homicide case?
It's quite common. Throughout my career, before going to The Hague, I was involved in prosecutions of organised criminals, and it was very common to seek the evidence of co-offenders in circumstances where, without that evidence, the main perpetrators may not be able to be brought to justice. So it's not an uncommon set of circumstances that these people be given immunity to enable them to give evidence, I should say, in the trial.
And when this comes to trial, is that immunity made clear to the jury, and is it the subject of conversation in the trial about immunities being offered and the advantages this might give to those witnesses?
The prosecution usually does not make that set of circumstances known. However, it's very common, in fact, I think in every case, that when the witness is giving his evidence, the defence will put it to him in cross-examination that the only reason that he's giving evidence is that he's been given an immunity and he's just trying to prevent himself from being prosecuted. So therefore, his credibility is potentially affected because of this reason. And I would be very surprised if such a scenario was not presented in the trial of Mr. Ben Robert Smith.
In the trial of Ben Robert Smith, which will take place in the years to come. Former soldier Ben Roberts Smith, following his release after the granting of bail, addressed the media over the weekend and described his case as unprecedented, describing his arrest in Sydney Airport earlier as a sensational and unnecessary spectacle. Quote, "For the past 10 years, my family and I have been subject to a campaign to convince Australians that I've acted improperly in my service in Afghanistan. As I've always maintained, I categorically deny all these allegations. While I would have preferred these charges not to be brought, I will be taking the opportunity to finally clear my name." Graham Blewett, do you have a view about the circumstances and the media coverage and the footage that we saw accompanying his arrest at Sydney Airport?
I must say that when I saw that footage, I asked myself, was this really necessary? It seemed to me that his arrest could have been effected in ways that were not so sensational. And him being arrested on an aeroplane with his family present, as he said, it would have been traumatising for his children. And it seemed to me at the time that it was probably unnecessary to show that footage and to arrest him in that way that would be sensational. So I tend to agree with his criticisms of the AFP.
At the press conference announcing the arrest, the head of the Office of the Special Investigator was asked why the charges took so long to be brought. And he responded by speaking to the complexities of investigating these sorts of allegations in a war zone 9,000 kilometres away from Australia, in a country that we cannot access currently under the Taliban rule. And that meant there was no access to crime scenes, photos, site plans, blood splatter, no access to the remains of the deceased. How might those challenges be overcome?
There's no doubt that the investigation and prosecution of war crimes is a difficult, complex and lengthy process. However, if one considers that back in the 1980s and early 1990s, Australia did investigate war criminals from living in Australia who committed crimes or alleged to have committed crimes in Europe during the Second World War. The Special Investigations Unit that was set up to do that.
Of which you were very much involved.
Yes, I was initially the Deputy Director and later became the Director of the Special Investigations Unit, the SIU. The circumstances that we were investigating crimes that were decades old, that had been committed on the other side of the world, and then involved people who had become Australian citizens. But the process established quite clearly that it was possible to conduct investigations where crimes were committed overseas. And it's to be remembered that the Soviet Union was still in existence at the time, and all of our investigations involved inquiries within the Soviet Union. And the SIU was able to achieve successful investigations.
And prosecutions?
There were three prosecutions that were commenced. None of them resulted in a conviction. One of them, however, did result in the matter getting to trial before a jury in Adelaide. And a lot can be said about that process, but it established that it was possible to conduct investigations overseas involving crimes that were committed a long time ago and that where Australia had no connection with those crimes. And then following that, with the United Nations War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, those investigations commenced when the war was still raging in the Balkans. yet the prosecution was able to conduct investigations and to bring charges when the war was still raging. So it's certainly difficult to investigate and prosecute war crimes, but those two instances that I've just mentioned show that it can be done. It's also, in my view, relevant that media organisations were able to get into Afghanistan and to interview the alleged victims and survivors and witnesses to those events. So it seems to me that whilst there would have been difficulties, there may have been ways for the OSI to get into Afghanistan. I must say, however, I have no idea what attempts were being made and what challenges they had faced in that regard. But I would concede that it would have been difficult, but I have a question mark in my mind as to whether it would have been impossible to do so.
So we have, a number of years ago, the defamation case and the ruling of Justice Bezanko finding against Ben Robert-Smith in his defamation action against Nine Media and several journalists. And as I understand it, Justice Bezanko found on the balance of probabilities, Ben Robert-Smith was responsible for a number of unlawful killings. What's the difference between that civil defamation case and the upcoming criminal trial?
A substantial difference between the two proceedings. On the balance of probabilities is a balancing act by the judicial officer to determine whether or not a case has been proved or not. It's termed the civil standard, and the test is on the balance of probabilities. However, in a criminal trial, and in this case, these war crimes trials must be held in front of a jury of 12 people, and any verdict must be unanimous. But the prosecution, and they bear the onus of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused has committed the crimes. So that's the onus, and it's a much higher bar, and it's much more difficult to prove than a case being presented on the balance of probabilities. It's the standard in all criminal trials and even international crimes. The beyond a reasonable doubt standard is the acceptable position that the prosecution must prove.
Finally, Graham Blewett, what's the way forward from here? Ben Robert-Smith has just been released on bail. We have this statement of alleged facts released by the prosecution. What will happen from here on in?
There'll be a series of mentions leading up to a situation where Mr. Ben Robert-Smith will or will not be committed for trial. And that proceeding will take place once all of the evidence has been disclosed to the defence. So once full disclosure is made, the matter will be set down for a committal, and eventually the judge will make a decision whether there's sufficient evidence to put him on his trial. And if there is, then the matter then gets transferred to the Supreme Court. And once again, the process will start with a series of mentions. And once all the national security matters are finalised, then the court can set that down for a trial. I would imagine that it could take at least 2 to 3 years and perhaps more. So that's what's going to happen. And eventually the matter will be listed for a hearing before a jury of 12 Australian citizens, and the trial will progress. And I should imagine that the trial would be a lengthy one.
Graham Blewett, thank you very much for speaking to The Law Report.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's all we've got time for this week. Do follow The Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and audio producer Elise Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.